waited, and she sat on the sofa with her eyes lowered as Kohlhaas Walker Jr. spoke his formal conversation and played the piano for her. It was only when they were seen together that it became apparent he was a good deal older than she was. Mother insisted that the members of the family excuse themselves so that the courtship could go on in privacy. Nothing was speeded by this. After the visit, Sarah looked irritated and even angry. She was slow to forgive, and in some peculiar way, her stubbornness seemed the only appropriate response to his persistence. Sarah had attempted to kill her newborn child. Life was not something either of these people took carelessly. They lived in brutal subjection to their hopes and feelings. They suffered themselves. Mother's younger brother understood this perhaps more clearly than anyone in the family. He had spoken to Kohlhaas Walker just once, but admired him immensely. He saw in the way the black man acted upon his intentions more manhood than he himself possessed. He brooded over this. Younger brother understood the love in some hearts as a physical tenderness in that part of the body, a flaw in the physiological being equivalent to rickets of the bones or disposition of the lungs to congest. He was afflicted with this, and so was Sarah, colored though she was. He thought she was some displaced African queen. Her very awkwardness as she moved suggested that it would be grace in another country. And the more reluctant she seemed to accept Kohlhaas Walker's offer of marriage, the more younger brother understood what a terribly afflicted heart she had. But one Sunday in March, with the wind blowing softer and small brown buds visible on the branches of the maple trees, Kohlhaas arrived in his shining Ford and left the motor idling. Neighbors in the yards came out to watch the strange, intense black man, burly and correct, with his dark, dark eyes on the verge of crossing, and the beautifully awkward Sarah, wearing a pink shirtwaist and a black skirt and jacket and one of Mother's wide-brimmed hats, as they walked under the Norwegian maples and down the concrete steps to the street. She carried her baby. He helped her into the car and got up behind the wheel. They waved to the family and drove off through the suburban streets to the farmlands at the north end of town. They parked at the side of the road. They watched a cardinal skim the hard brown earth, then beat its way to the highest, thinnest branch of a tree. This was the day he asked her to marry, and she accepted. The appearance of these magnificent lovers in the family's life had been startling. The conflict of their wills had exercised an almost hypnotic effect. Chapter 22. And now Mother's younger brother began again his trips to New York. He would work at his drawing table past the dinner hour and then catch an evening train. He had made friends of some ordnance officers on duty at the armory on Lexington Avenue and 34th Street. They complained about the Springfield rifle. They showed him their small arms and their grenade bombs. He knew immediately that he could design better weapons. He drank with the officers. It became known at the stage doors of several Broadway theaters. He stood in the alleys like others, never so well groomed as some of the older men, nor so carelessly handsome as the collegians from Princeton or Yale. But there was an intensity of expectation about his eyes that attracted a fair number of women. He was always so serious and unhappy that they were persuaded he loved them. They took him for a poet. Still, his salary couldn't support these tastes. Broadway was alive with lights and entertainments, and everyone connected with the theater and charged by its excitement lived to the limit. He learned where to find women who would go to bed with him for a modest price. One of these places was the Bethesda Fountain in Central Park. They walked in twos whenever the weather was mild. The days were beginning to lengthen. In cold, luxurious sunsets they strolled about the fountain, shadows filling the great steps, the water already black, the paving stones brown and pink. He amused them by taking them seriously. He was gentle with them, and they didn't mind his oddity because it was gentle. He would take a woman to his hotel room and then sit in a chair with one shoe in his hand and completely forget about her. Or he would not attempt to make love, but only inspect her intimate places. He drank wine until he was insensible. He dined in steakhouses with sawdust on the floor. He went to cellar clubs in Hell's Kitchen, where hoodlums bought everyone drinks. He walked Manhattan at night. his eyes devouring passers-by. He stared in the windows of restaurants and sat in hotel lobbies, his restless eyes picking out motion and color before it defined itself. Eventually, he found the offices of the Mother Earth magazine, published by Emma Goldman. They were on 13th Street in a brownstone that served now as the anarchist residence when she was in New York. He stood in the street under the lampposts and stared at the windows. He did this for several nights. Finally, a man came out of the door, walked down the steps, and crossed the street to where he stood. He was a tall, cadaverous man with long hair and a string tie. He said, "It gets cold in the evenings. Come in. We have no secrets." And younger brother was led across the street and up the steps. It turned out that in his vigil he had been mistaken for a police spy. He was treated with elaborate irony. He was offered tea. Numbers of people were standing about in the apartment in their hats and coats. Then Goldman appeared in the doorway, and her attention was directed to him. "Good God," she said, "that's no policeman." She began to laugh. She was putting on a hat and setting it in place with hatpins. He was thrilled that she remembered him. "Come with us," she called. A while later, younger brother found himself in the Cooper Union down near the Bowery. The hall was hot, crowded to overflowing. There were lots of foreigners. Men wore their derbies, though indoors. It was a great stinking congress, garlicked and perfumed in its own perspiration. It had met in support of the Mexican Revolution. He hadn't known there was a Mexican Revolution. Men waved their fists. They stood on benches. Speaker after speaker arose. Some spoke in languages other than English. They were not translated. He had trouble hearing. What seemed to have happened was that the Mexican peons had spontaneously revolted against Diaz, the president of Mexico, for the past 35 years. They needed guns. They needed ammunition. They were striking from the hills, attacking the Federals and the supply trains with wooden staves and muzzle-loading muskets. He thought about this. Finally, Emma Goldman got up to speak. Of all the orators, she was the best. The hall went quiet as she described the complicity of the wealthy landowners and the despised tyrant Diaz, the subjugation of the peons, the poverty and starvation, and most shameful of all, the presence of representatives of American business firms in the national councils of the Mexican government. Her voice was strong. As she moved her head and gesticulated, the light flashed from her glasses. He pushed his way forward to be closer to her. She described one Emiliano Zapata, a simple farmer of the Morelos district, who had turned revolutionary because he had no choice. He wore the share farmer's bleached pajama coat and trousers, bound over the chest with bandoliers and belted with a cartridge belt. "My comrade," she cried, "that is not a foreign costume. There are no foreign lands. There is no Mexican peasant. There is no dictator Diaz. There is only one struggle throughout the world. There is only the flame of freedom trying to light the hideous darkness of life on earth." The applause was deafening. The younger brother had no money. He turned out his pockets, mortified to see all around him people who reeked of their poverty coming up with handfuls of change. He found himself standing at the foot of the speaker's platform. The speeches were done. She stood surrounded by colleagues and admirers. He saw her hug a swarthy man who wore a dark suit and tie, but also an enormous sombrero. She turned, and her glance fell on the balding, blondish young man, whose head came just above the platform stage, as if severed like a French Republican's, the eyes turned upward in a kind of ecstasy. She laughed. He thought at the end of the rally that she would speak to him, but there was a reception for the Mexican back at the offices of Mother Earth. He was the Zapatista representative. He wore boots under his cuffless trousers. He did not smile but drank tea and then wiped his long mustaches with the back of his hand. The rooms were crowded with journalists, bohemians, artists, poets, and society women. Younger brother was not aware that he was following Goldman about. He was desperate for her attention, but she was enormously busy with everyone else. Each new person who came in the door had to be seen. She had lots on her mind. She introduced people to each other. To different persons she proposed different things they must do, others they should speak with, places they ought to go, situations they ought to look into or write about. He felt incredibly ignorant. She went into the kitchen and whipped up the batter for a cake. "Here," she said to younger brother, "take these cups and put them on the table in the big room." He was grateful to be taken into her network of useful people. There were posters of Mother Earth magazine covers on every wall. A tall, long-haired man was dispensing the punch. He was the one who had come out to the street to invite younger brother upstairs. He looked like a Shakespearean actor down on his luck. His fingernails were outlined in black. He was drinking as much as he dispensed. He greeted people by singing a line or two from a song. Everyone laughed who spoke to him. His name was Ben Reitman. He was the man Goldman lived with. There was something the matter with the top of his head. There was a shaven patch. Noticing younger brother's glance, he explained that he'd been in San Diego and had been tarred and feathered. Emma had gone there to speak. He acted as her manager, renting the halls, making the arrangements. They had not wanted Emma to speak. They had kidnapped him, driven him somewhere, stripped him and tarred him. They'd burned him with their cigars and worse. As he gave this account, his face darkened, his smile disappeared. An audience had gathered. He was holding the punch ladle, and it began to click against the side of the bowl. He couldn't seem to let go of it. He gazed at his hand with a peculiar smile on his face. "They did not want my mama to speak in Kansas City or Los Angeles or Spokane," he said. "But she spoke. We know every jail. We win every case. My mama will speak in San Diego." He laughed as if he couldn't believe his own hand shook as it did. The ladle clicked against the bowl. At this point, a man pushed his way to the table and said, "You think, Reitman, the world is well served by your being tarred and feathered?" He was a short, totally bald-headed man with thick eyeglasses, a large, full mouth, and a very sallow complexion with skin like wax. "The issue has become Emma's right to speak rather than what she has to say. All our energies go into defending ourselves. That is their strategy, not our own. I'm afraid you don't understand that. What is so glorious, poor Reitman, about being bailed out of the tank by some guilty liberal so that then he can congratulate himself? How is the world advanced?" The two men stared at each other. Goldman's voice called cheerfully from the back of the gathering. "Sasha!" She came around the table, wiping her hands on her apron. She stood next to Reitman. She gently removed the ladle from his hand. "Sasha, my dear," she said to the sallow man, "if first we have to teach them their own ideals, perhaps then we may teach them ours." The party went on into the early hours. Younger brother despaired of getting her attention. He sat Indian style on an old couch with sagging springs. After some time he realized the room was quiet. He looked up. Goldman was sitting on a kitchen chair directly in front of him. The room was otherwise empty. He was the last guest. Unaccountably, tears came to his eyes. "You actually asked if I remembered you," Emma Goldman said. "But how could I forget? Could anyone forget such a sight as that, my pagan?" She touched his cheek with her thumb and mashed away a tear. "So tragic, so tragic." She sighed. "Is that all you want from your life?" Her large, magnified eyes peered at him through the lenses of her eyeglasses. She sat with her legs apart, her hands on her knees. "I don't know where she is, but if I could tell you, what good would that do? Suppose you got her to come back to you. She would only stay a while. She would run away from you again. Don't you know that?" He nodded. "You look terrible," Goldman said. "What have you been doing to yourself? Don't you eat? Don't you get any fresh air?" He shook his head. "You have aged 10 years. I cannot sympathize. You think you are special, losing your lover? It happens every day. Suppose she consented to live with you after all. You're a bourgeois. You would want to marry her. You would destroy each other inside of a year. You would see her begin to turn old and bored under your very eyes. You would sit across the dinner table from each other in bondage, in terrible bondage to what you thought was love. The both of you. Believe me, you are better off this way." Younger brother was crying. "You're right," he said. "Of course, you're right." He kissed her hand. She had a small hand, but the fingers were swollen and the skin was red and the knuckles were enlarged. "I have no memories of her," he sobbed. "It was something I dreamed." Goldman was unappeased. "This way you could feel sorry for yourself," she said. "And what a delicious emotion that is. I'll tell you something. In this room tonight you saw my present lover, but also two of my former lovers. We're all good friends. Friendship is what endures. Shared ideals, respect for the whole character of a human being. Why can't you accept your own freedom? Why do you have to cling to someone in order to live?" He bowed his head as she talked. He stared at the floor. He felt her fingers under his chin. His head was lifted, tilted up. He found himself staring into the faces of Goldman and Reitman. From Reitman's scatterbrained smile, a gold tooth gleamed. They peered at him, curious and interested. Goldman said, "He reminds me of Solgos." Reitman said, "He is educated, a bourgeois." "But the same poor boy in the eyes," Goldman said. "The same poor, dangerous boy." Younger brother saw himself standing in line to shake the hand of William McKinley. A handkerchief was wrapped around his hand. In the handkerchief was a gun. McKinley fell back. Blood dyed his vest. There were screams. When he left, she hugged him at the door. Her lips, surprisingly soft, pressed his cheek. He was overcome. He stepped back. The literature under his arm fell to the floor. There was laughter between them as they crouched in the doorway and gathered it up. But an hour later, he stood between the cars and the milk train going up to New Rochelle. He considered throwing himself under the wheels. He listened to their rhythm, their steady clacking like the left hand of a rag. The screeching and pounding of metal on metal where the two cars joined was the syncopating right hand. It was a suicide rag. He held the door handles on either side of him, listening to the music. The cars jumped under his feet. The moon raced with the train. He held his face up to the sky between the cars, as if even moonlight could warm him. Chapter 23. One Sunday afternoon, the colored man Kohlhaas Walker said goodbye to his fiancée and drove off to New York in his Ford. It was about 5 o'clock in the evening, and shadows of the trees darkened the road. His route took him along Firehouse Lane, past the station house of the Emerald Isle Engine. A company of volunteer firemen, known for the dash of their parade uniforms and the liveliness of their outings. In the many times he'd gone this way, the Emerald Isle volunteers would be standing and talking outside the firehouse, a two-story clapboard building, and as he drove past they would fall silent and stare at him. He was not unaware that in his dress and as the owner of a car he was a provocation to many white people. He had created himself in the teeth of such feelings. At this time, private volunteer companies were maintained as auxiliaries to the municipal fire department, and these companies, which relied upon private subscription, had yet to motorize their equipment. As the Negro came along, a team of three matching gray engine horses cantered out of the firehouse into the road, pulling behind them the big steam pumper for which the Emerald Isle was locally renowned. They were immediately reined, causing Kohlhaas Walker to break his car abruptly. Two of the volunteers came out of the building to join the driver of the pumper, who sat up on his box, looking at the Negro and yawning ostentatiously. They all wore blue work shirts with green handkerchief ties, dark blue trousers, and boots. Kohlhaas Walker released the clutch and climbed down to crank his car. The volunteers waited until this was done and then advised him that he was traveling on a private toll road and that he could not drive on without payment of $25 or by presenting a pass indicating that he was a resident of the city. "This is a public thoroughfare," Walker said. "I've traveled it dozens of times, and no one has ever said anything about a toll." He got up behind the wheel. "Tell the chief," one of the men said to another. Walker decided to put the Ford into reverse gear, back up to the corner, and go another way. He turned in his seat. At this moment, two of the firemen, carrying a 20-foot ladder between them, came into the street behind the car. Two others followed with another ladder, and others came out with quarts of coiled hose, buckets, axes, hooks, and other firefighting equipment, all of which was deposited in the street, the company having chosen this particular moment to sweep out its quarters. The chief of the company was distinguished by a white military cap he wore at a cocky angle. He was also somewhat older than the rest. He was courteous to Kohlhaas and explained that while the toll had never before been collected from him, it was nevertheless in force, and that if Kohlhaas did not pay up, he would not pass. With his two hands, he lifted his hat from his head and reset it so that the visor covered his eyes. This caused him to tilt his chin upwards in order to see, giving him a pugnacious look. He was a heavy-set man with thick arms. Many of the volunteers were grinning. "We need the money for a fire truck," the chief explained, "so we can drive to fires just like you drive to whorehouses." The Negro calmly considered the courses of action available to him. The Emerald Isle firehouse looked across the street to an open field that sloped down to a pond. Conceivably, he might drive off the road, turn in the field, and circumnavigate the ladders and hose cord. But he was wedged in tightly, and even if he could pull the wheel hard enough to clear the horses, the severe angle of the turn might tilt the car over on the downhill slope. Apparently it did not occur to him to ingratiate himself in the fashion of his race. Playing down at the edge of the pond were a couple of Negro boys, 10 or 12 years old. "Hey," Kohlhaas Walker called to them, "come on up here." The boys came running. They stared at Kohlhaas as he switched off the engine, set the brake, and stepped down to the road. "I want you to watch this car," he told them. "When I come back, you tell me if anyone touched it." The musician quickly strode back to the corner and headed toward the business district. After 10 minutes, he found a policeman operating a stop-and-go traffic signal. The policeman listened to his complaint and shook his head and spent some time removing his handkerchief from under his frock coat and blowing his nose. "Those boys don't mean no harm," he finally said. "I know them all. Go on back now. They're probably tired of the sport." Walker may have realized this was probably the maximum support he could expect from a policeman. At the same time, he may have wondered if he'd been oversensitive to what was intended as no more than a prank. So he went back to Firehouse Lane. The fire engine and horses were withdrawn. The road was empty of volunteers, and his car stood off the road in the field. He made his way to the car. It was spattered with mud. There was a 6-inch tear in the custom pantasote top, and deposited in the back seat was a mound of fresh human excrement. He went across the street to the firehouse door. Standing there with his arms folded was the chief in his white military cap and green bohemian tie. "The police department advises me there is no toll road anywhere in the city," Kohlhaas Walker said. "That's right," the chief said. "Anyone is free to come and go on this road any time he thinks he has to." The sun having set, the electric lights were on inside the firehouse. Through the glass panels in the door, the Negro could see the 3 matching grays in their stalls, the great nickel-plated pumper with its brass fittings backed up to the rear wall. "I want my car cleaned and the damage paid for," he said. The chief began to laugh, and a couple of his men came out to join the fun. At this moment, a police van drove up. It carried 2 officers, one of them the traffic policeman to whom Kohlhaas Walker had appealed. He went into the field, looked at the car, and came back to the firehouse. "Willie," the policeman said to the fire chief, "did you or your boys do any desecrating?" "I'll tell you exactly what happened," the chief said. "The nigger here parked his damn car in the middle of the road right in front of the firehouse. We had to move it. It's a serious business blocking a fire station. Ain't that so, boys?" The volunteers nodded righteously. The big policeman came to a decision. He took Kohlhaas aside. "Listen," he said, "we'll push your Tin Lizzy back on the road and you'll be on your way. There's no real damage. Scrape off the shit and forget the whole thing." "I was on my way when they stopped me," Kohlhaas said. "They put filth in my car and tore a hole in the top. I want the car cleaned and the damage paid for." The officer had now begun to appreciate Kohlhaas's style of speech, his dress, and the phenomenon of his owning a car in the first place. He grew angry. "If you don't take your automobile and get along out of here," he said loudly, "I'm going to charge you with driving off the road, drunkenness, and making an unsightly nuisance." "I do not drink," Kohlhaas said. "I did not drive my car off the road, nor slash the roof, nor defecate in it. I want the damage paid for, and I want an apology." The policeman looked at the chief, who was grinning at his discomfiture, so that the issue for him was now his own authority. He said to Kohlhaas, "I'm placing you under arrest. You'll come with me in the wagon." Early that evening, the telephone rang at Broadview Avenue. The caller was Kohlhaas, and after quickly explaining that he was at police headquarters and why, he asked Father if he would consider putting up bail so that he could get to the city and not miss work that evening. It is to Father's credit that he responded at once, holding back his questions until there was the leisure to have them answered. He called for a cab and went down to the station house and there wrote a check for the amount, which was $50. But as he reported the incident to Mother, he was put off because Coalhouse Walker was barely civil in his gratitude and rushed off to the train station saying only he'd make good the sum. The next evening, the household experienced the oddness of a visit by Coalhouse Walker that was not on a Sunday. He sat in the parlor with his arms folded and told the story in detail. There was no aggrieved tone in his voice. He recited calmly and objectively, as if he were describing something that had happened to someone else. Mother said, "Mr. Walker, I am ashamed that this community is represented in your mind by that bunch of toughs." Father said, "The company has a bad reputation. They're an exception, the other volunteer engines being in all ways upright and responsible." The younger brother sat on the piano stool with his legs crossed. He leaned forward, totally engaged by the problem. "Where is the car now?" he said. "And what about those two boys? They are witnesses for you." But the pianist had spent the afternoon tracking down the boys, only to find their parents refusing to have them involved in the matter. "I'm a stranger to the Negroes here," he said matter-of-factly. "They have to live here, and they want no trouble. As for the car, I have not looked at it again, and I won't until it is returned to me, as it was when I drove away from this house yesterday evening." Standing in the hallway just out of sight during this interview was Sarah. She held her baby on her hip, and she listened. She perceived, as no one in the family could, the enormity of the misfortune. She heard Father say to Coalhouse that if he intended to pursue his claim, he should engage a lawyer. There was such a thing as the power of subpoena for witnesses. "Are there any colored lawyers here?" Coalhouse asked. "I don't know of one," Father said, "but any lawyer who loves justice will do, I should think." He paused. "I will underwrite the expense," he said in a gruff voice. Coalhouse stood. "I thank you, but that won't be necessary." He put an envelope on the side table. In it was $50 in cash. This, Mother learned afterward, had come out of the money he was saving toward the wedding. The next day, Mother's younger brother took it upon himself to go to the site of the incident and see the car. After work, he rode his bicycle to Firehouse Lane. The Model T had been thoroughly vandalized. Whether by the volunteers or others, it was impossible to determine. It sat with its front end in the tall weeds at the edge of the pond. The wheels were sunk in the mud. The headlamps and the windshield were shattered. The rear tires were flattened, the tufted upholstery had been gutted, and the custom pantasote top was slashed to ribbons. Chapter 24 Younger brother stood at the pond. Since his evening with Emma Goldman, he had been in considerable difficulty. People at work were surprised by his animation. He fixed his attention on anything that could sustain it. He produced small talk that verged on hysteria. He sat at his drawing table and turned out designs in endless modifications for rifles and grenades. He measured the small squares and made his computations and watched the point of his pencil as it impressed the paper. When there was no other recourse, he would begin to sing just to hear the sound. Thus, with continuous concentration and the expenditure of enormous amounts of energy, he tried to keep himself from slipping into the vast distances of his unhappiness. It was all around him. It was a darkness as impudently close as his brow. It choked him by its closeness, and what was most terrifying was its treachery. He would wake up in the morning and see the sun coming in the window, and sit up in his bed and think it was gone, and then find it there after all, behind his ears or in his heart. He decided he was on the verge of a nervous collapse. He prescribed for himself a regimen of cold baths and physical exertion. He bought a Columbia bicycle and rode it to work. At night, before bed, he would do calisthenics until he was exhausted. On the floor below, Mother and Father felt the house shake. They realized he was jumping up and down. They were used to his eccentricities. He had never confided in them or shared his hopes or feelings, and so they saw no marked change in his behavior. Mother did ask him to join them in the parlor after dinner when he had no plans for the evening. He tried this. He heard them address him, heard himself answer. He saw them in their suffocating parlor with its chaise and mounted heads and fringed lampshades, and he felt he couldn't breathe. He despised them. He thought they were complacent, ordinary, and inconsiderate. One evening, Father read to everyone the editorial in the local newspaper. Father liked to read aloud when he found something particularly instructive or well-written. The title of the editorial was The Spring Peeper. "So that diminutive visitor to our ponds and fields has come to call once again," Father read. "In truth, he is no less ugly than his older brothers, Frog and Toad. But we welcome the gallant little fellow and laud his beauty, for is he not in advance of Robin and even hardy Crocus in his proclamation of the spring?" The young man rushed from the room, convinced he was strangling to death. There's no question, then, that younger brother was fortunate to conceive a loyalty to the colored man. Standing at the pond, he heard the lapping of the water against the front fenders of the Model T. He noted that the hood was unlatched, and lifting and folding it back, saw that the wires had been torn from the engine. The sun was now setting, and it threw a reflection of blue sky on the dark water of the pond. There ran through him a small current of rage, perhaps 1/100th, he knew, of what Coalhouse Walker must have felt, and it was salutary. Here, given subsequent events, it is important to mention what little is known about Coalhouse Walker, Jr. Apparently he was a native of St. Louis, Missouri. As a young man, he had known and admired Scott Joplin and other St. Louis musicians, and had paid for his piano studies with money he earned as a stevedore. There's no information about his parentage. At one point, a woman in St. Louis claimed to be his divorced wife, but that was never proved. There were never located any of his school records in St. Louis, and it is still not known how he acquired his vocabulary and his manner of speaking. Perhaps by an act of will. It was widely reported, when he was achieving his notoriety, that Coalhouse Walker had never exhausted the peaceful and legal means of redress before taking the law into his own hands. This is not entirely true. He went to see 3 different attorneys recommended by Father. In all cases, they refused to represent him. He was advised to recover his automobile before it was totally wrecked and to forget the matter. To all 3, he insisted that he didn't want to forget the matter, but to bring suit against the fire chief and the men of the Emerald Isle engine. Father himself telephoned one of these attorneys, a man who had represented his firm in several business matters. "Is there not a case there?" he asked. "When he goes for his hearing," the lawyer said to Father, "you can go with him. You don't need me for this. When a property owner in this city walks into court with a Negro, a charge like this is usually dismissed." "But he's not interested in the charge," Father said. "He wants to sue." At that point, Father realized the attorney was involved in a conversation with someone in his office. "Glad to be of help," the attorney said, and rang off. It is known also that Coalhouse Walker consulted a black attorney in Harlem. He had learned that the Emerald Isle chief, whose name was Will Conklin, was a stepbrother of the judge of the city court and a nephew of a county alderman in White Plains. The Harlem attorney advised them there were ways to divert the case to other jurisdictions, but these were expensive and time-consuming, and the outcome was not at all predictable. "You have the money for that?" the lawyer said. "I am soon to be married," Coalhouse Walker said. "That is an expensive proposition," the lawyer said. "Surely your responsibilities to your intended are more important than the need to redress a slight on the part of white folks." Then Walker apparently made a remark not entirely courteous to the black lawyer. The counselor stood up behind his desk and told him to leave. "I have charity cases you know nothing of," he shouted. "I want justice for our people so bad I can taste it. But if you think I would go to Westchester County to plead on a colored man's behalf that someone deposited a bucket of slops in his car, you're very much mistaken." It is known, too, that Coalhouse made a preliminary attempt to see the matter through as his own counsel. He had filed a complaint, but didn't know how to go about getting a place on the court calendar, or what steps had to be taken to assure that it was correct in form in order to be heard. He appeared at City Hall for an interview with the office of the county clerk. It was suggested that he return another day, when there was less pressing business in the office. But he persisted, and was then told that his complaint was not on file, and that several weeks would be required to trace it. "Come back then," the clerk told him. Instead, he went to the police station, where he had originally filed, and wrote out a second complaint. Policemen on duty regarded him with amazement. An older officer took him aside and confided to him that he was probably filing in vain, since the volunteer fire companies were not municipal employees and therefore did not come under the jurisdiction of the city. The contemptuousness of this logic did not escape Kohlhaas, but he chose not to argue with it. He signed his complaint and left, and heard laughter behind him as he walked out the door. All of this happened over a period of 2 to 3 weeks. Later, when the name Kohlhaas Walker came to symbolize murder and arson, these earlier attempts to find redress no longer mattered. Even at this date, we can't condone the mayhem done in his cause, but it is important to know the truth insofar as that is possible. Conversation at the family's dinner table was now obsessive on the subject of the strange, proud black man's attempts to have his property restored. It seemed like such a foolish thing to have happened. It seemed to be his fault somehow, because he was a Negro, and it was the kind of problem that would only adhere to a Negro. His monumental negritude sat in front of them like a centerpiece on the table. While Sarah served, Father told her that her fiancé would have done better after all to drive away his car when he could and forget the matter. Younger brother bristled. "You speak like a man who's never been tested in his principles," he said. Father was so outraged by this remark that he could find no words. Mother said gently that no one would be helped by the voicing of intemperate feelings. A peculiar kind of unseasonably warm breeze blew through the window curtain in the Egyptian dining room. It had that breath of menace which makes the beginning of the spring so unsettling. Sarah dropped a serving tray of fillet of sole. She retreated to the kitchen and held her baby. Sobbing, she told younger brother, who followed her there, that the preceding Sunday, Kohlhaas had said he could not marry until he had been satisfied by the return of the Model T in exactly the same condition as when the fire horses had been driven across his path. Chapter 25. Nobody knew Sarah's last name or thought to ask. Where had she been born and where had she lived, this impoverished, uneducated black girl with such absolute conviction of the way human beings ought to conduct their lives? In the few weeks of her happiness, between the time she accepted Kohlhaas's proposal and the first fears that her marriage would never happen, she had been transformed to the point of having a new, a different face. Grief and anger had been a kind of physical pathology masking her true looks. Mother was awed by her beauty. She laughed and spoke in a mellifluous voice. They worked together on her wedding dress, and her movements were altogether graceful and lithe. She had an excellent figure, and she gazed at herself in the mirror with pride. She laughed in joy of her own being. Her happiness flowed in the milk of her breasts, and her baby grew quickly. He was pulling himself to his feet, and the carriage was no longer safe for him. He stayed with her in her room. She picked him up and danced with him. She was a girl of perhaps 18 or 19 years, now satisfied that the circumstances of life gave reason to live. She was, Mother realized, the kind of moral being who understood nothing but goodness. She had no guile and could act only in total and helpless response to what she felt. If she loved, she acted in love. If she was betrayed, she was destroyed. These were the shining and dangerous facts of the life of an innocent. The boy was attracted to her more and more, and to her baby. He played gently with the child, and there was solemn recognition between them. The mother sang. She sewed her wedding costume and tried it on and removed it. Underneath she wore a shift which rose to her hips as she pulled the white dress over her head. She saw the boy's honest and attentive regard of her limbs, and she smiled. To younger brother she offered the unspoken complicity of two members of the same generation. Her husband-to-be was an older man, and younger brother was set apart by age from the others in his family. And that was why he followed her into the kitchen, and she confided to him the news of Kohlhaas's vow not to marry until he had his car back. "What will he do?" younger brother said. "I don't know," Sarah said. But she had perhaps detected the violence underlying all principle. The following Sunday, Kohlhaas Walker did not appear for his visit. Sarah returned to her room. It was now clear to Father that the situation was deteriorating. He said it was ridiculous to allow a motor car to take over everyone's life as it now had. He decided to go the next day and talk to the Emerald Isle contingent, especially to Chief Conklin. "What will you do?" Mother said. "I will make them see they are dealing with a property owner of the city," Father said. "If that doesn't work, I will quite simply bribe them to repair the car and return it to my door. I will pay them money. I will buy them off."
"Mr. Walker would not like that," Mother said.
"Nevertheless," said Father, "that's what I'm going to do. We will worry about explanations later. They are the town dregs and will respect money." But before the plan could be undertaken, Sarah decided on a course of action of her own. As it happened, this particular season was the spring of an election year. A candidate on the National Republican ticket, Mr. Taft's vice president, James Sherman, was to be in New Rochelle that evening to speak at a Republican Party dinner to be held at the Tidewaters Hotel. She had remembered overhearing Father discuss his reasons for not attending the event. Knowing little of government nor appreciating the degree of national unimportance of her Cole House's trials, Sarah conceived the idea of petitioning the United States on his behalf. It was the second of the frightened and desperate acts provoked from her innocence. She waited in the evening until her child was safely asleep, and wrapping a shawl about her head, left the house without telling any member of the family, and ran down the hill to North Avenue. She was shoeless. She ran swiftly as a child. She was prepared to run all the way to the hotel, but instead found a streetcar coming along, its interior lights flickering, the driver tolling its bell angrily as she dashed across the tracks just in front of it. She paid the fare and rode downtown. An evening wind came up, and in the dark sky great heavy clouds massed for a rainstorm. She stood in front of the hotel among a small crowd of people awaiting the arrival of the great man. Car after car drove up and gave forth this dignitary or that. A few windswept drops of rain spattered the sidewalk. A carpet had been laid from the curb to the hotel doors. Not only the local police in their white evening gloves, but a platoon of militia were on hand, keeping the entrance cleared and pushing the crowd back from the street in anticipation of the arrival of the vice president's car. The militia were in constant attendance, as well as plainclothes men of the Secret Service, which had been commissioned to protect presidents and vice presidents by Theodore Roosevelt after the assassination of President McKinley. As a matter of fact, Roosevelt had come out of retirement this season to run against his old friend Taft. Wilson was the Democratic candidate, Debs the socialist, and the four campaigns whipped back and forth across the country, blowing up hopes on the land like the winds that ruffled the great plains. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, just a week or so before, Roosevelt had arrived to make a speech. Leaving the railroad station and walking to a car, he had been kept separate from a welcoming crowd. One man stepped out of the crowd and aimed a pistol at point-blank range. Shots rang out. A bullet tore through the spectacle case in Roosevelt's breast pocket, ripped a hole in the 50 folded pages of his speech, and lodged in his rib. He was stunned. The assassin was wrestled to the ground. There were shouts. Roosevelt examined his wound and was satisfied it was not serious. He went on to make his speech before he allowed doctors to treat him. But the acrid smoke of the act still lingered in the public mind. Anyone commissioned to guard a personage could not help thinking of the shooting of Teddy Roosevelt. New York City's mayor, William J. Gaynor, had been bloodied by an assassin's bullets not too long before. Guns were going off everywhere. When the vice president's car, a Panhard, rolled up to the curb and the man himself stepped out, a cheer went up. Sonny Jim Sherman was a New York State politician with many friends in Westchester. He was a round, balding man and in such ill health that he would not survive the campaign. Sarah broke through the line and ran toward him, calling in her confusion, "President! President!" Her arm was extended, and her black hand reached toward him. He shrank from the contact. Perhaps in the dark, windy evening of impending storm, it seemed to Sherman's guards that Sarah's black hand was a weapon. A militiaman stepped forward, and with the deadly officiousness of armed men who protect the famous, brought the butt of his Springfield against Sarah's chest as hard as he could. She fell. A Secret Service man jumped on top of her. The vice president disappeared into the hotel.
In the confusion and shouting that followed, Sarah was put in a police wagon and driven away. Sarah was held at the police station overnight. She was coughing blood, and in the early morning hours it occurred to the sergeant in charge that perhaps she ought to be looked at by a doctor. She had puzzled them all, answering no questions, looking at them with eyes of fear and pain, and had one of them not recalled hearing her cry, "President, President," they were prepared to regard her as a deaf-mute. "What were you doing?" they asked her. "What did you think you were doing?" She was transferred to the hospital in the morning. It was a gray, overcast day. The vice president was gone. The festivities were over. The street sweepers pushed their brooms in front of the hotel, and the charge against Sarah was reduced from attempted assassination to disturbing the peace. She lay in the hospital. Her sternum and several ribs were fractured. At home on Broadview Avenue, Mother heard the baby cry and cry, and finally she went upstairs to see what was the matter. Some hours passed before the family's alarms were connected by a police officer to the colored girl who had been put in the hospital. Father coming from his business and Mother from the house, they found Sarah in a bed on the public ward. She was sleeping. Her forehead was dry and hot, and a bubble of blood on the corner of her mouth inflated and deflated with each breath. By the next day, Sarah had developed a pneumonia. They pieced together the story from the few things she said. She paid little attention to them and kept asking for Kohlhaas. They arranged to have her placed in a private room. Not knowing where Kohlhaas lived, they put in a call to the Manhattan Casino and reached the manager of the Clef Club Orchestra. In this way, Kohlhaas was located, and a few hours later he was sitting by Sarah's bedside. Mother and father waited outside the room. When they looked in again, Kohlhaas was on his knees beside the bed. His head was bowed, and with his two hands he held the hand of Sarah. They retreated. Afterward they heard the sepulchral sounds of a grown man's grief. Mother went home. She held the baby constantly. The family was devastated. They could not seem to keep warm. Everyone wore sweaters. The younger brother fired the furnace. Toward the end of the week, Sarah died. Chapter 26. The funeral was made in Harlem. It was lavish. Sarah's coffin was bronze. The hearse was a custom Pierce Arrow opera coach with an elongated passenger compartment and a driver's cab open to the weather. The top was railed with brass and banked with masses of flowers. Black ribbon flew from the four corners of the roof. The car was so highly polished the boy could see in its rear doors a reflection of the entire street. Everything was black, including the sky. The street curved to a precipitous horizon. There were several town cars for carrying the mourners to the cemetery. The mourners were mostly musicians, associates of Kohlhaas and the Clef Club Orchestra. They were Negro men with closely cropped hair, tightly buttoned dark suits, rounded collars, and black ties. The women with them wore dresses that brushed the tops of their shoes, wide-brimmed hats, and small furs around their shoulders. When the mourners were in the cars and the doors were shut, and the chauffeurs had got in behind their wheels, everyone heard a fanfare, and there came up the street to take its place in the procession an open omnibus with a five-piece brass band in tuxedos. Kohlhaas Walker paid for the funeral with the money he had saved for his wedding. He had secured a plot for Sarah through his membership in the Negro Musicians Benevolent Association. The cemetery was in Brooklyn. The band played dirges through the quiet streets of Harlem and all the way downtown. The cortege moved slowly. Children ran behind it, and people on the sidewalk stopped to stare. The band played as the car slowly crossed the Brooklyn Bridge high over the East River. Passengers on the trolley cars along the outer lanes of the bridge stood up in their seats to see the grand parade. The sun shone. Gulls rose from the water. They flew between the suspension cables and settled along the railing as the last of the cars went by.
Chapter 27. Spring, spring! Like a mad magician flinging silks and colored rags from his trunk, the earth produced the yellow and white crocus, then the fox grape, the forsythia flowering on its stalks, the blades of iris, the apple tree blossoms of pink and white and green, the heavy lilac, and the daffodil. Grandfather stood in the yard and gave a standing ovation. A breeze came up and blew from the maples a shower of spermatozoic soft-headed green buds. They caught in his sparse gray hair. He shook his head with delight, feeling a wreath had been bestowed. A joyful spasm took hold of him, and he stuck his leg out in an old man's jig, lost his balance, and slid on the heel of his shoe into a sitting position. In this manner he cracked his pelvis and entered a period of declining health from which he would not recover. But the spring was joyful, and even in pain he wore a smile. Everywhere the sap rose and the birds sang. Upstate, at Matawan State Prison Farm, Harry K. Thaw nimbly jumped over a ditch in a road and stepped on the running board of a waiting locomobile. He hooked his elbow about the roof post, gave an exultant cry, and the car drove off. Thaw escaped to Canada, leaving a trail of outraged waitresses and stunned hoteliers. He abducted and whipped a teenage boy. He was beginning to work out his problems. Eventually he came back across the border. He was discovered on a train near Buffalo and ran through the cars, giggling and panting as police detectives set up pursuit. In the dining car he turned and threw heavy silvered individual coffee pots he plucked from the tables of astonished diners. He climbed up between the cars and ran along the top of the train in a kind of simian lope, leaping down upon the observation platform and standing with his arms outstretched to the sun as the police burst through the door and grabbed him. Thaw would not divulge the name of the person who helped him escape. "Just call me Houdini," he said. An enterprising reporter decided to find the great magician and solicit a comment. He was that kind of reporter, expert in the stupid and inconsequential news story so loved by the papers of the time. Houdini was found in a cemetery in Queens, where he was observing the spring on his knees beside his mother's grave. He looked up with a swollen and laughable face of grief. The reporter stole away. All around the graveyard the dogwood was in flower, and the fallen magnolia petals lay in circles under the trees. Houdini wore a black wool suit, and the sleeve of the jacket was torn near the shoulder. His mother had been dead for some months, but every morning he awoke with his wound as fresh and painful as if she had died the night before. He had cancelled several bookings. He shaved only when he remembered to, which was not often, and with his reddened eyes and stubble and baggy suit, he looked like anything but the snappy magician of international fame. It is a Jewish custom to leave small stones at the gravesite to show that a visit has been made. Mrs. Cecilia Weiss's burial mound was covered with pebbles and small stones, one upon another, so that a kind of pyramid was forming. He thought of her at rest in the coffin under the earth. He wept bitterly. He wanted to be next to her. He remembered his attempt to escape from a coffin, the terror when he realized he could not. The coffin had a trick lid, but he had not anticipated the weight of the earth. He had clawed at the earth, feeling its monumental weight. He had screamed into its impenetrable silence. He knew what it was to be sealed in the earth, but he felt now it was the only place for him. What good was life without his beloved little mother? He hated the spring. The air filled his nose and mouth like clotted soil. In his brownstone on 113th Street near Riverside Drive, Houdini arranged framed photographs of his mother to suggest her continuing presence. One close-up he laid on the pillow of her bed. He placed an enlarged photo of her seated in a chair and smiling in the very chair in which she had posed. There was a picture of her in a hat and coat walking up the stairs from the street to the front door. He hung this on the inside of the door. One of her prized possessions had been an oak music box with a glass window in its lid so that one could see the large tine disc in rotation. There were several discs to choose from, but her favorite had been the one that played Gaudiamus Igitur on one side and Columbia the Gem of the Ocean on the other. Houdini cranked up the music box and played these tunes every evening. He dreamed they were her voice. He had saved the letters she had written to him over the years and now had them translated into English and typed so that he could read them easily and relive them without fear of their turning to dust from overuse. He stood in the door of her closet and breathed the redolence of her wardrobe. The old woman had taken ill while Houdini was in Europe. He had looked forward to describing to her his meeting with the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but before he could write her, she had died. He secured a release from his performing contracts and sailed home as quickly as he could. He remembered nothing of the voyage. He was out of his mind with grief. The burial had been delayed until his return. He learned that she had called for him moments before her death. She had suffered a paralytic stroke. "Eric," she had moaned, "Eric, Eric." He was tormented with guilt. He was obsessed with the idea that she'd wanted to tell him something, that she had had something to tell him that she could reveal only then, at the moment of her death. He had always been skeptical of occultists and the spiritual claims of clairvoyance and mediums. In his early days with the Welsh Brothers Circus in Pennsylvania, he had himself exploited the gullibility of rubes by claiming transcendental powers for his tricks. Blindfolded, he would tell a Confederate what item had been held for his identification by someone in the audience. "What is this, Mr. Houdini?" the Confederate would say, and he'd know. It was all done by code. Sometimes he would claim to speak with the dead and give some poor sucker whose name and circumstances they had managed to figure out a message from a loved one who had passed on. So he knew what spiritual fraud was. He could recognize it. Spiritual fraud had been rampant in the United States since 1848, when two sisters, Margareta and Kate Fox, invited neighbors to hear the mysterious rappings in their house in Hydesville, New York. But it was the very fact of his expertise that persuaded him now to consider the possibility of finding someone who had genuine gifts as a medium. If it was possible to communicate with the dead, he would find out. He could recognize and unmask any fake act in the world. Therefore, if he found the real thing, he would know it. He wanted to see his mother Cecilia's tiny figure and feel her hands touch his face, but since that could not be, he decided to see if it was really possible to speak with her. And at this time in our history, communication with the dead was not as far-fetched an idea as it had once been. America was in the dawn of the 20th century, a nation of steam shovels, locomotives, airships, combustion engines, telephones, and 25-story buildings. But there was an interesting susceptibility to occult ideas of the most famous pragmatists in the land. Of course, it was all very hush-hush. A rumor in certain circles had it that Pierpont Morgan and Henry Ford had formed a secret society, and he knew that the horticultural wizard Luther Burbank, who crossbred and developed hybrids with increased crop yields, talked secretly to plants and believed they could understand him. The great Edison himself, the man who invented the 20th century, had theorized that irreducible particles of life-charged matter, which he called swarms, subsisted after death and could never be destroyed. Houdini tried to get in touch with Edison. He asked for an interview, but the great man was too busy. He was working on an invention so secret that there was frequent speculation in the press as to what it might be. One news story came out claiming the new invention was something called a vacuum tube, by which Edison hoped to receive messages from dead people. Houdini desperately sent off telegrams begging and pleading for an interview. He was rebuffed. He offered money to help fund the work. He was rebuffed. He swore to himself that he would invent his own instrument, just as he had learned to fly his own airplane. Whatever Edison began with came from the storehouse of technology available to everyone. Houdini bought books and began a study of mechanical physics and the principles of the storage battery. He vowed that by whatever medium, mechanical or human, if there was life after death, he would discover it. His passion, in no time at all, came to the attention